This is the One Thing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Rindy. The One Thing Podcast brings together leaders in functional and naturopathic medicine to discuss actionable information that may unlock puzzles in the areas of gut health, brain health, metabolism, and longevity. Please note, these episodes do not replace the opinion of your doctor. They are not intended to diagnose or treat any condition. Please discuss this information with your provider and discuss your own unique personal health history before adapting this information. Please subscribe to our episodes so that you can stay on top of the most current information in these areas of medicine. Hey, everybody. Dr. Adam Rindy. It's so great to be here with you again. I'm so delighted to bring on our next guest, Dr. Candice Esposito. She is someone who inspired me in the first place to do a podcast way back when, 10 years ago, when I first heard her podcast, The Calm Living Blueprint. She is now evolved in her work and is doing some really great integrative programs for people struggling with anxiety and anxiety-related disorders. She is on the podcast with me today, and we had a great discussion about the healing trap, how we get stuck in places where we feel like we're not okay and have a difficult time getting to a place where we feel okay with our health and ourself and our acceptance. We talk about the inner drivers of anxiety, and we talk about social anxiety. The conversation went into aspects of modalities that can help with anxiety, also how the root of many illnesses is being out of alignment with our true self, and also how part of illness is related to trauma. She's doing really good integrative work that includes polyvagal theory, also includes aspects of psychotherapy, nutrition, gut health, environmental medicine, and even spirituality and mysticism. So without further ado, I welcome you to this most interesting discussion we had on living calmly. Thank you so much for being here. Please spread the word with this podcast and share it with those that you think that would benefit from hearing this information. Candice, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. It's such an honor to be here with you today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Adam. It's been a long time coming, and I'm so grateful to be here.
Yes, we were sharing offline that you were my main inspiration of starting my podcast in the first place, and to my surprise that it was around 10 years ago when I first heard your podcast. It was an inspiration to me back then, and I eventually launched my own podcast. So thank you for being a pioneer and sharing this kind of information to people in this format.
Yeah, I was touched to hear that. I didn't know that about you. So I was touched to hear that. And it kind of blows my mind to think that I had started the Calm Living podcast over 10 years ago too. it's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very soothing podcast for me to listen to during a time when I was really needing that source of inspiration and comfort. So, and then, here we are talking today. So it's quite exciting to me.
Coming full circle. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to hear that you got some benefit from it. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, there's so much that I want to discuss with you and the limited time we have together. But I think one of the main reasons I reached out to you is you have a really amazing way to encapsulate issues related to anxiety and anxiety-related disorders. And sort of a vision, which is called the Calm Blueprint. And I thought we could just start off with hearing about the Calm Blueprint, what kind of the origin story of the Calm Blueprint.
Yeah, it really comes out of my own personal experience. And, you know, my experience over 20 plus years with severe social anxiety. I share about this in the first episode of the Calm Living Blueprint podcast, but it had gotten to the point, so it was in my years in university where it was kind of most intense, but it reached the point where, you know, it was all I could do, even just to go out for groceries. I remember going hungry at times because I was just, you know, so anxious and so afraid just to walk a couple blocks down to the grocery store. And so it had gotten to a point where it just kind of reached its head and I was like, you know, this has got to change. I can't go on living this way. So I made a promise to myself that I would figure things out no matter what. And so it took a while. It was years of trial and error. And, you know, me experiencing what I call now the healing trap, where I had this identity of being broken, right? Being damaged, not being worthy, that I needed to be fixed. And so seeking out a solution from this practitioner, you know, to that practitioner, this therapist, to this counselor, personal development, self-help programs and tools and so on and so on. You know, ultimately getting to a place where I had taken, kind of synthesized or filtered out different tools and aspects from my journey, from those trial and error experiences that were in service to me, that were working for me. And I eventually got to a point where I had people coming up to me and saying things like, oh, you know, you change, you seem calm, you seem like a different person. And so that kind of started cluing me into the fact that there had been that shift that had happened and wanting to share that with others. And so that was the impetus for the Calm Living Blueprint. At that point, I had already kind of been in naturopathic practice, I think, for a couple of years, still early on. But then my desire to want to help others superseded, I guess, my fear of putting myself out there in terms of a podcast, which was good. But I still remember that anxiety before hitting that publish button.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your format was essentially you sharing teachings and insights and inspirations. And where has it evolved to today? Like what, how does the Calm Blueprint play a role in the things that you're focused on today?
Yeah, it was interesting because I, you know, recently launched what I called the Calm Living Online Retreat, a retreat from anxiety. And so in preparation for launching that retreat, I had returned to the material that I had put together for the Calm Living Blueprint way back when. And I had created this manifesto. The title was From Fear to Dare. And the first line was, I am not broken. I don't need to be fixed. Mm. And I was like, wow, like that's basically the message that I'm really passionate about communicating now in the work that I'm doing with others, that it just like intuitively has been coming up again and again more recently. And I just thought that was serendipitous or, you know, whatever word you want to use there, that, yeah, I felt like I had come full circle from, you know, that being kind of the central premise of the Calm Living Blueprint. So the actual blueprint itself back then was 6 steps. A lot of the aspects or kind of the tools were taken from acceptance and commitment therapy, which mm-hmm. was one of the key tools that I had utilized myself. I remember not really resonating as much with cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, the idea of kind of like replacing the negative thoughts with positive thoughts. I was like, well, the negative thoughts just keep coming up. I need a better approach or a different approach to this anyway. Not to say that that's not the case for others, but, just the sense of getting some space, diffusing, from the thought so that you can be in that state of the observer. You know, that part of ourselves that could see the thought or the feeling for what it is, and then act from that place, that kind of place of being diffused rather than all tangled up in the thought, which is really what causes the problem is that we're buying into this thought that may not even be true, that often is just illusion. And so the Calm Living Blueprint had 6 key steps that were mapped out to help people shift their relationship with the thoughts and the feelings that trigger anxiety. And then the key part of it was really about implementation and taking action so that it's not just something that we're learning up here, but actually putting it to practice. Yeah.
Very nice. So the therapeutic modality, you know, that you were drawn to, so it sounds like it had kind of an influence on your current work. What do you think, you sort of mentioned this, but I'd like to go a little bit deeper into that. Like, what do you think is, what is the reason, in its acceptance, acceptance and
commitment therapy, or what's often the acronym that's often used is ACT, A-C-T.
ACT, right. Yeah. And so with acceptance and commitment therapy, what is the reason you feel like it's such a bridge? Is it the fact that it creates, you were saying, like a space of kind of allowing to move through the emotion? What do you feel like is the real essence of that type of therapy?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I liked ACT and using that as a tool because I found it was an easy doorway into addressing the thoughts and the feelings, right? So there's the aspect, like I said, of diffusion where you're creating that space between yourself and the thought. So the analogy that's often used is like if you were standing beside a stream and there was, you know, leaves that had fallen to the stream that are floating down, and you imagine the leaf as one of those thoughts. So you have the choice there, you know, not to jump in the stream and, you know, let the current take you versus just observing the leaf as it floats, you know, down the stream. And so, you know, that felt easier, simpler to me. Because then you have a choice in each and every moment, you know, whether you choose to buy into that thought, so to speak, accept it as the gospel truth and, you know, act from there versus saying, you know, I'm just going to let that pass by. You know, I don't need to get tangled up in that. I don't need to buy into that. It's not in service to who I want to be or the life that I want to live. And so to me, that felt really empowering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the emotion or the feeling side of it is what they call acceptance, okay? And that's where you're just essentially making space to allow the feeling to be. The analogy that's often used there is if you imagine you're in a tug of war with an emotion monster, and you know you can't win that tug of war. You can, you know, pull as hard as you want, roll that rope up, but you're never gonna win. And so the answer is to let go of the rope. So you let go of the rope, you let go of that resistance to trying to do anything about the feeling or the emotion, to simply, you know, create space for it. The idea that, you know, if you imagine ourselves as the sky being expansive, almost limitless, right? And a feeling is kind of like a cloud in a storm cloud in the sky. As much as it rains, thunders, pours, eventually that storm cloud will evaporate and the sky remains untouched, right? It's not harmed at all by that storm cloud. And so too with ourselves, right? The feelings, the emotions can never really harm us. And so kind of using that approach, those analogies, those teachings, I find we're kind of an easy doorway into dealing with those thoughts and emotions.
Oh, that's really profound. And I think I'd love to circle back and kind of talk about the kind of original point that you made about the healing trap, because I think you know, so many people can relate to that. And it's almost like, in a sense, like the hero's journey in a way, you know, some of us are kind of born in that kind of realm. It seems, you know, like we're on that journey of trying to get to that place of accepting ourselves or embracing ourselves, and that we're okay as we are.
Yeah.
So let's go more into that. So, I mean, are people, do you come across people that are sort of born whole and you know, that's just kind of, things are good and they don't have their journey? Or do you feel like we all have a journey?
That's a good question. I don't know is my answer to that. I my sense is, you know, everyone comes into this world as being whole. That's our true nature, our default. That's what resonates with me. And we all have our journey. So I think of it more as an and rather than either or.
Yes.
I think both are happening. Yeah, and so, I mean, the healing trap to me is similar to what I described in my own personal experience. And I have witnessed this in, you know, the clients that reach out to me, the patients that reach out to me. It's, you know, being a naturopathic and functional medicine doctor, it's often the last resort, right? You know, people have gone through the conventional medical system, have kind of sought out answers elsewhere. And then at least, you know, the people that I tend to interact with are like, you know, haven't been able to find answers elsewhere. You know, can you help me out? And that journey is often one of jumping from practitioner to practitioner with the underlying, I think, belief of, I need to be fixed. There's something wrong with me, right? I'm broken. I'm damaged in some way. And I think that, you know, that self-limiting belief comes in from different aspects, or maybe is hammered home through environmental influences, you know, developmental trauma, these different sources, right? That maybe kind of layer it down. So part of what I'm really passionate about communicating now, as I said, with the messaging that I'm using, is that, you know, health isn't fixed. It's an evolving potential. And I'm starting to use the word health creator, health creation, as opposed to even patient. One of the kind of the concerning processes that I was seeing in myself as a practitioner. So I speak based on my own personal experience and realizing that I was part of the problem here. But then I also kind of am witnessing this as a trend, I think, in the wellness industry overall, is getting into the relationship of, like, if you think of the drama triangle, right? So you have the perpetrator, the rescuer, and the victim. And so if we apply this to health and people's experience, so you have someone with debilitating symptoms, say exhaustion, fatigue, anxiety, depression, chronic pain, what have you, that's having a large impact on their day-to-day life, right? Really influencing all aspects of their life. A person in that state is going to be more susceptible to thinking along the lines of victim consciousness, right? Those thoughts that I just mentioned, I am broken, I need to be fixed. Mm-hmm. They're more susceptible to those types of thoughts. So you get someone in that state, you combine that with, you know, a system, be it conventional system, the wellness industry, holistic, like I said, functional medicine, naturopathy, that then comes in as the position of the rescuer, you know, the person with the solution. Mm-hmm. But the concern with that is that it's still disempowering, right? Because, you know, I saw myself as acting as the gatekeeper, right? I'm the one with the access to the functional medicine testing or the special professional line supplements that you're needing. And so is that approach, is that setup any different than, you know, say the conventional medicine setup of handing over a prescription and telling the patient, this is, you know, what you need mm-hmm. to take? It's still one of disempowerment, mm-hmm. right? To me is very concerning, because I think, well, true holistic health should be self-empowering, right? And so it was that kind of development that I was starting to see in myself, how I was practicing, even though the intentions were good, you know, it was coming mm-hmm. from a good intention place, but I was like, right. Well, is this really how I want to work with people? And so that started getting me questioning, even with the language that I was using. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand what you're saying and can see that play out quite a bit, you know,
yeah.
in day-to-day clinical practice. And it's really challenging to disentangle that, because in a sense there are expectations on both sides sometimes that these relationships are actually functional,
mm-hmm. and
yeah. that this is the way the dynamic should be.
Yes. Yeah. It's set up within the system to play out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what's sort of on the other end of the spectrum of that is having partnerships, you know, with providers or other people in your life, or people you consult with, where it's supportive.
Mm-hmm.
So have you seen shifts in the way that you interacted with your patients, where you felt like there was like this dynamic now that was sustaining for you and the your client and who you were working with, in a way that felt right, felt functional?
Yeah. So, I mean, it started with bringing that awareness, right, to the process and how I was interacting, and simply asking, like, is this in alignment to how I want to be, how I want to show up in the world, right? And that's very personal. And so from there, saying, well, what could that look like, right? What would I like that to look like? Setting mm-hmm. aside any perceived limitations. And that's what really kind of inspired me to get on the track of more the health creation, you know, empowering individuals to, you know, step into that role of health creator, because I really believe each and every one of us are health creators, that, you know, we have the ability to create our own reality and what we want our health and our life to be like, to look like. And that felt lighter to me, you know, even to change the languaging and approach it that way on kind of a practical level, like what that looks like. That was the impetus for creating our online community, which I've called the Health Creators Collective, to support that process, right? To help people become self-empowered, to support them to learn how to think about it in terms, as opposed to like, this is what you need to do, right? So it's more about like the principles and the foundation, you know, creating that really strong foundation. And then you can apply that regardless of what your circumstances or, you know, individual situation is.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's so much movement in that area. At least, you know, I'm seeing patients or, you know, health creators want to be more empowered and being more empowered and doing their own research and coming with questions that feel like they're honoring themselves and taking a big part in their health. So I do think it's happening. I also just want to frame some of this is that there are situations, you know, where if you have a deep trust with someone and you're in a state of overwhelm and you can't detach from your own health, your own situation, where you might trust in someone to say, I need you to guide me. I'm inviting you to.
Yes.
So do you see that? Can you talk more about those situations? Because that seems like in some sense related to anxiety and overwhelm, is that sometimes it's really hard to, you know, be in a state where you can actually see yourself clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, it needs to be kind of customized or personalized, you know, for each individual. You know, if someone is in that state or I'm observing that, probably the first thing I would do is simply to ask permission, right? So is, you know, I'm sensing this. Is it okay if I kind of, so you're coming at it more, I guess, as a consultant, right? You're providing some answers or simply saying, you know, if I was you, this is what I would be doing, right? Rather than say maybe more from the coaching aspect of trying to support them to come to that answer themselves, right? Mm-hmm. I kind of see that as maybe the differentiation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of the first things that I'll work on with a client who may be in that overwhelmed state is the nervous system regulation, right? So they're anchoring themselves back to that ventral vagal or safe place, and then they can act from that place, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll bring in that piece very early on to address that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fascinating because if you know, looking at this through the kind of the trauma lens and thinking about that, I started in my own practice implementing an ask for everything I do, like everything I want to do. So instead of saying, I need you to sit on the table, I'm going to take your blood pressure, I'm going to take your temperature, I'm going to take your heart rate, go stand on the scale, I need your weight, you know, like, no.
Yes. Yeah.
May I take your blood pressure? Is it okay if I look inside your mouth? Is it okay if I examine your lymph nodes?
Yes.
Every little step of the way, when there's that consent and that permission and that, like, yes, you can. Yes, I'm okay with it.
Yes.
Yeah. Those micro moments are really profound. And I've noticed the connection and trust between me and the people that come to see me for health advice or health, you know, consultations has really gone up. And I feel better about the interaction because it feels more aligned with my values.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. I think so too. And I think probably what you're doing as a result of that is creating a safe place, right? You're creating that co-regulation, which speaks to the therapeutic benefit that they're receiving simply from the relationship with you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in the world outside of a clinical room, even how we interact with other people about their health problems or their, what they're going through and their other problems, it's like, okay, so if someone is going through a hard time and then you bombard them with advice, you know, without them wanting it, it can create a similar type of dynamic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not going to land, or it could create further anxiety and overwhelm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's usually coming from a good place. So I think, you know, if someone is listening to this and they're like, oh, I did that yesterday.
The intention behind it is usually one. It's coming from a good place, like you said.
It's either I don't want to feel the discomfort that I'm experiencing from the other person, or I don't want them to feel the discomfort, right?
Yeah.
And the advice is kind of like a way of getting an uncomfortable emotion to leave the room or attempt to.
Yeah. And that probably speaks to our own work, right? Like I think of, becoming trauma informed myself, the process there, it, you know, came from personal experience, you know, my own trauma experience, needing to do that work and regulate my own nervous system. And then being able to be in a place where I get it. Cause I, you know, I've had that experience myself. And I think, yeah, like you said, just creating that place where then they feel safe and okay to be vulnerable themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard a really profound quote. I wish I would have wrote it down. Yes, it was yesterday. I wish I would have wrote down who said it, but I can probably find that somewhere. Is that we are who we truly are when we're silent. And when we speak, we're being something we're trying to create.
Yeah.
And so when we're with people and we're listening to them, the best thing we can do to give them ourselves is just silence.
Yeah, stillness. Oh, yeah. I mean, it makes me think of when I first started off in practice and just like preparing for a new patient, like for initial consultation, the copious notes I would take, the research that I would do, the questions that I'd have all, you know, prepped to ask them. And now it's like none of that. It's like I just need to be present. And that's my intention. If I could be present with this individual, like truly present, what needs to come through will come through. And exactly what you're, you know, getting at, I think, in the quote is just that place of stillness, where I think within stillness and silence, we're more apt to embody our true selves. And if you can just be your true self with this individual, this other being in front of you, that's all that's needed, really.
Yeah. And it's healthiest for both people, yeah, right?
For sure.
Because you can sustain and show up and be yourself,
yes,
on any given moment. But if you're trying to be something you're not, that's not, yeah, sustainable.
So absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really, really profound. And then, you know, you think about that prepping, like you said, for the interaction with the patient. I mean, I can, yeah, totally relate to that. I remember doing that as well. Like, and then you think about it, like each person that you interact with, like how many unique steps has that person taken to end up in front of you? It's, mm-hmm, just, it's almost like a miracle. And, you know, yeah, to think that some textbook is going to get you ready for that interaction.
I know. What do you think of it that way? Yeah, it's like, what are we doing? Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously good to be prepared and know what you're talking about from a standpoint of like basic kind of structure. But
of course. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's kind of look at anxiety a little bit more. And I'm just curious, you know, with your thoughts about what with anxiety, like what's the opposite of anxiety? Is there a true opposite, or is there any degree opposite of being in the world where you have lack of anxiety? What does that look like?
For me, the opposite of anxiety is presence, because I know when I'm present, it's physiologically impossible to be anxious at the same time. You know, it's a red flag when I'm feeling anxious or depressed that I'm not present. I'm not in the here and now. So that's what immediately comes to mind when you ask for an opposite. I think it can also look like calm, you know, inner peace from mind. You know, we talk about peace of mind, but I think probably the more accurate way to say it is peace from mind, right? Peace from that hamster wheel, that constant chatter, what I often call Brian. You know, thanks, Brian, for that thought. Yeah, to me, that would be the opposite, or kind of maybe the other side of the spectrum of anxiety. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. So I think like presence also has elements of like trust and, you know, faith. Faith. And, you know, that you have what you need right now, right here, to deal, yeah, with what's in front of you. And this is what matters.
Yeah, exactly. I'm okay in this moment.
Mm-hmm. And anxiety has sort of a benefit too, right? So a lot of people, you know, go pretty far in careers and professions because they're anxious. Mm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of situations, and I think my own experience is an example of this, of, you know, high functioning anxiety or even high functioning depression, where on the outside, you can appear calm, collected, kind of having it all together, you know, your emotions in check. And so it's not perceived as being a state of dysregulation, but it can be as dysregulated as, say, someone who is more of that highly reactive state, right? It may be manifesting differently. On the inside, you know, there's dysregulation happening. And so, you know, I think people are fed, you know, those notions. You can kind of get away with it in large part in society if you have that high functioning state of anxiety that you're in, or that it's not manifesting as being highly reactive, right? It's not going to be noticeable. I mean, I flew through school in that state, and, you know, no one ever asked me what's wrong or how are you feeling, or, you know, is there something that needs to be done about this, right? Totally under the radar. So I think that's probably one aspect. And then the other is fear of the other side, right? Like, that's what's known. That's what feels comfortable. You know, what's on the other side of that? What would that look like? What would that feel like? And so there's, I think, a fear component that plays a role there too. Self-identification, right? Self-labeling, like we become identified with that, that anxiety. And like you said, you know, a lot of people kind of climb the ladder, or, you know, get to these what's deemed as high places in society based on that as fuel, adrenaline, you know, that's mm-hmm. driving them, that could be part of that anxiety process in their body. Yeah
And, you know, just to go into that a little bit further, I mean, there's employers that, you know that there are certain people you can go to, you know, for certain functions or projects or deadlines or, you know, fact finding or problem solving, and their, you know, kind of anxious nature might make them really shine in a particular role of, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of perfectionism or what have you. And I think you can get rewarded to that, and then you become kind of the person that that is the go-to. I see that happening a lot with a lot of people I work with, is because they're really suffering, but their suffering is seen as a strength in certain settings. So it's rewarded. And it's kind of a trap. And I've actually seen patients really have a tough time unwinding that and learning, you know, just to say, you know, I'm not going to be this person anymore. It's not healthy for me.
Yeah. That's a tough thing to do. I mean, that's an act of courage in and of itself, because it's a shedding, a letting go of, right? It's like you're letting that identity or that part of yourself die off in order to shift into that healthier one. Yeah.
So the social anxiety piece is sort of its own journey in itself. And I think that's something I can personally relate to really well. And I've always thought of it being a very physiologic process, you know, where there's, you know, different types of anxiety. Social anxiety has a true physiologic piece, Would you say that?
I would agree. Are you meaning like in terms of the experience, like the symptoms, the state that it produces?
So, right. So it's, you know, there's anxiety where, you know, you kind of excessive worry or, you know, which is maybe called generalized anxiety disorder. Or, you know, then there's obsessive compulsive subtypes and trauma subtypes, but like social anxiety, you know, there's a physical change where you can have, you know, heart rate changes, flushing of the skin. And can you talk about that? Like how that kind of doubles down on that experience? Because
Well, there's a vicious cycle that develops where people then become anxious about the symptoms, right? They become anxious about sweating in public, perspiring in public, their face flushing in public. So at the core of social anxiety is fear of other people's judgment. And that seems to be compounded with those symptoms that are manifesting very outwardly, or what at least the person perceives as being, you know, seen very outwardly. Yeah. Even though, you know, say the next person may not be noticing their face flushing or that their, you know, their hands are sweating.
Yeah. And, you know, as we're learning more about neurodiversity too, I think there's a lot of emphasis discussed, especially in certain people with autism spectrum disorder that have social anxiety can be one of the main symptoms. Have you come across that in your,
your
experience?
Yeah, I have. I would say, you know, a good percentage of, especially the original clients that I worked with under that Calm Living umbrella, would have been considered, you know, on the spectrum to varying degrees. So yeah, I would say that that is the case. It seems to be a strong overlap there. Yeah, and I mean, it just speaks to, I guess, the complexity too of how, you know, you can have the symptom that, you know, on the one level is manifesting very differently, you know, depending on the person. Like social anxiety for one person may look like withdrawing into a corner, whereas the other person, you know, they could be observed as being like extroverted on the inside, you know, are feeling those panic attack symptoms. So yeah, there's a wide range.
Right. And, you know, some people have learned how to mask, you know, their social anxiety, and, you know, it might become across as like a social awkwardness versus social anxiety, or feeling socially awkward. So yeah, I think it's, you know, I think that I don't want to get too far from, you know, the essence of what we're talking about as far as, moving with this and moving through this. So when someone's kind of landed in this place, is there sort of, can you talk about the different elements of day-to-day life of working with some of the things that you teach people with? Is it, what are some of the modalities and elements of how people kind of learn from you?
So it's a 9-step process that's kind of evolved from the original Calm Living Blueprint that I've now called Health Creation Blueprint. So the first step is always to bring in awareness and that self-reflection piece and figuring out the root causes. You know, what are those root causes specifically for this individual, those imbalances that ultimately led to them having these concerns in the first place? You know, in the people that I worked with, so it's been over, you know, 17 years of clinical practice now. And what I've noticed is that you know, that you can really kind of pare the root causes down to a couple of things. One is trauma that's been stuck in the body. And two is living out of alignment with you know, how the person wants to show up in their life and who they truly are. And that out of alignment piece, it can look like different things, right? That part will vary, but there's something that's just isn't in honor with who they are. And I find that when we tackle that, you know, the shifts start happening. The nervous system regulation piece is a big one. So the tool that I love to use is the Safe and Sound Protocol, which was developed by Dr. Stephen Porges.
I did that training.
Yeah. So that's an auditory therapy. Very gentle. I mean, I love it. I went through it myself. It was actually the first tool I used after I was on the other side of that more recent experience with trauma. And so it was my experience working through that, kind of the shifts I noticed in myself that led me to say, hey, I want to get certified in this. And it's become one of the go-to tools that I use in practice now. I love it because people don't necessarily have to get caught up in the story so much. You know, I think a lot of people have experience of talking about their story and having to talk about it again and again, kind of marinate in it, so to speak. And that can be sometimes a source of resistance for people seeking out health, because help is they don't want to have to rehash their story again or relive that, right? Whereas with the Safe and Sound Protocol, it's more about bringing a sense of openness and willingness to the process and just allowing the process to happen. Mm-hmm. It's very eloquent and gentle, which is why I love it. And it being an auditory therapy, it helps to regulate the vagus nerve. And then, you know, we have what happens in session. So when I'm in session with the client and there's things coming up when they feel triggered, we're working on ways to re-anchor them back to that safe state, the ventral vagal state. And that also is, I find, a very empowering process, because then they're learning those tools and techniques themselves. They can take that and then use that to maintain the gains they've made after the protocol is finished. Mm-hmm. With the functional medicine and naturopathy background, we always look at the gut. So, right. You know, healing the gut is a given. You know, looking at the possibility of toxins in the body and going through a drainage and detoxification process is a given. So those are usual you know, key steps that we walk people through, more at the physiological or physical level. And then I incorporate kind of elements from a process that I've worked through called dream porting. It's kind of based on a little bit of alchemy and mysticism thrown in there, but more that spiritual component of alchemizing those self-limiting beliefs, turning that into things that we can use to kind of fuel the action that we take to create that life that we want to live. So it's a bit of a blend of, you know, naturopathy, functional medicine, elements of my learnings from acceptance and commitment therapy. So kind of the psychosocial models, along with a little bit of magic and mysticism thrown in there too. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
So great. Yeah. That's so holistic, and you know, it seems like you probably tweak it as you go, as you know, it's an ongoing kind of process.
Yeah, I consider it to be evolving as well, in evolution, and more recently bringing in elements of, you know, kind of quantum biology and bioenergetics, which, you know, I'm really excited about, and kind of, you know, for myself, I approach that more from a beginner's mind. I don't claim to be an expert in those fields whatsoever, but they excite me, and, you know, I'm very curious about them, and I can definitely see the potential that they have too. The more I've kind of worked with clients, the more I'm kind of leaning towards the energetic piece too. So getting back to, you know, people being out of alignment, often it's happening at that energetic level or spiritual level. And I think if we're approaching it from a truly holistic place, we can't negate that. We can't ignore that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm smiling and nodding my head here because the vagus nerve work, like, really put that piece together for me, as far as like that we're such energetic beings.
Yeah.
And you know, when our energy is right and we lead with that.
Yes.
Like so much happens that is just so nurturing and nourishing and makes life kind of juicy and fun.
Yes. Everything seems to fall into place. Yeah.
Like flow, flow state, flow. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Like, it's so much of like you and I have been in practice for as long as similar time. And so like so much of my growing up was like this whole like self-help mentality. Like if you change this about yourself, then you can be this.
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, that created what we've, you know, that kind of like the first thing you said in this conversation, that just sets you up with like, oh, I'm not okay.
Exactly. And I think that's the trap that people can get into with personal development. And I know I did, you know, being kind of like self-labeled high achiever, right? You know, that idea of achieving and accomplishment, it just sets you up to go down that track. And that's not necessarily going to be what brings health.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, I'd love to sort of wrap up with just maybe some practical take-home messages that you might want to leave the folks listening to this with, and then just hearing how people could get involved with your work and where they can find you.
Sure. In terms of practical advice, the thing that I always go back to that I'm kind of constantly remembering to ask myself is, am I heeding my soul's cry? Like just that sense of where am I out of alignment, right? Or where may I not be honoring myself, right? And just looking at the different aspects of our life. Because when you come to those answers, that informs then what the action needs to be. So I would probably leave with that. And then in terms of connecting, I think the easiest thing is if, you know, people want to DM me one thing, then I'll know what that's related back to, and just to open up a conversation. So how can I help? How can I support you? Is there a free resource that I can send your way? If you're interested in working together, what could that look like? You know, what kind of plan could we put together?
Excellent. That's so helpful. Well, thank you so much for being here. This was really enlightening, and you just have such, I think the Stephen Porges' work has this concept called co-regulation, you know, of who you're sitting with and, you know, sort of how you feel when you're with that person. And like, you just have just such a natural gift to help others be balanced and to feel like moments of balance, just being in your presence. So it's truly a gift. And I thank you for modeling that.
Oh, thank you, Adam. Well, it's been an honor to be on the One Thing podcast. And again, thank you for asking me to be on. It's been a really great experience.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from that. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.